Welcome back to the Deep Dive. I want to start today by talking about architecture.
Building.
Not buildings, no.
Yep.
The architecture of medicine. You know, we usually think of the human body and the hospitals that treat it as a series of, well, distinct siloed departments.
Right.
If your chest hurts, you go to the third floor for cardiology. If you have a headache or a seizure, you go up to the fifth floor to neurology.
And never the twain shall meet. It's how the system is built, really. We
Yeah.
specialize just to survive the complexity of it all. The plumber doesn't usually come in to fix the electrical wiring, right?
Exactly.
Hmm?
But today, I have a stack of papers here on my desk that just completely blows those walls down.
Oh.
We are looking at a medical case study that proves, in a pretty terrifyingly visceral way, that the body does not care at all about our hospital floor plans. It's a case where the wiring on the fifth floor short-circuited so badly that it, well,
that is a very apt, if slightly frightening way to put it. We're looking at a case where the distinction between the brain and the heart, it just completely dissolves.
It does. We are diving into a specific case report. It was published in Epilepsy and Behavior Reports back in 2023. The title is a bit of a mouthful.
They always are.
Recurrent cerebellar ischemic infarctions and stereotyped periectal sympathetic responses in a near SODIP patient with cardiovascular risk factors. Now, that is dense.
It is dense, but every single word in that title is a clue. It's a clue to a really profound medical mystery.
And by the end of this hour, we're going to decode every single one of them. We're sort of acting as detectives today. Our subject is a 60-year-old woman. She enters the emergency room in a state of, absolute physiological chaos.
Yeah.
And her case offers us this incredibly rare window into a phenomenon called near SUDEP.
And this is a crucial concept to start with, I think. Most people who are, familiar with epilepsy have probably heard of SUDEP.
Sudden unexpected death in epilepsy.
Exactly. It's the leading cause of epilepsy-related mortality. And it's a tragedy that usually happens in the dark. A patient has a seizure, typically at night, alone, and they stop. They die.
And the really chilling part is what happens next, or rather, what doesn't.
Right. When the pathologists do the autopsy, they find nothing. No obvious heart attack, no stroke, no trauma, no drowning. Just a body that shut down.
It's a diagnosis of exclusion. It's what you write down when you can't find any other reason.
Precisely. And because the patient has passed away, we rarely get to see the mechanism in real time. We don't know what their heart rate was 10 seconds before death. We don't know what their blood chemistry looked like. We're left guessing.
But today's case is different. This is near SUDEP, or what the authors also call resuscitated SUDEP.
And that's the key.
Essentially, this woman died. Her heart stopped. She went into full cardiac arrest immediately after having a seizure. But, and this is both a miracle and the tragedy of the case, she was brought back.
She was resuscitated. And she survived long enough for the doctors to actually run tests.
And that survival, however brief it was, gave the medical team a chance to see the footprints of the killer.
Yes. They could see exactly what that seizure did to her heart, to her lungs, her blood chemistry. They caught the physiological storm, really, in the act.
So let's open the file. We need to understand who this woman was before the event. Because, looking at her chart, if she walked into a clinic, I don't think epilepsy is the first thing any doctor would think of.
Not at all. Not even close. In fact, it would probably be the absolute last thing on their mind. She was a 60-year-old female, and her medical history reads like a textbook case for metabolic syndrome and cardiovascular disease.
I have the list right here. Let's run through it because it's so important for what you could call the camouflage aspect of this case.
It's the perfect cover story.
It is. Okay, so first, she had obesity with a body mass index of 40.5.
Which is medically classified as severe obesity.
She had hypertension, so high blood pressure. She had hyperlipidemia, high cholesterol.
So already, any physician looking at her chart is just thinking heart risk. Big red arrows pointing to the heart.
Absolutely. And on top of that, she also had paroxysmal atrial fibrillation. That's AFib.
Right. And for anyone who doesn't know, that's an electrical issue in the heart itself, where the upper chambers, the atria, they sort of quiver instead of beating efficiently. It can cause a really irregular, often rapid heartbeat.
And it's a major risk factor for what?
Blood clots and strokes. It's one of the first things we look for when someone presents with a stroke.
Okay, so we've got a patient who is basically a walking collection of cardiac risk factors.
She is. She also had depression and restless leg syndrome on her chart.
Right. But here is the kicker. This is the detail that makes this entire case a house of cards. She had no known history of epilepsy.
Zero. Not on her chart, not something she ever reported.
And strangely, no sleep apnea, which is something you mentioned. Usually with a BMI of 40, you'd almost expect sleep apnea, which also puts a lot of stress on the heart.
You would. But she didn't have that. So as far as she knew, and as far as her doctors knew, she was a cardiac patient, plain and simple.
That's what the authors call the perfect storm. You have a patient with a very vulnerable heart and a vulnerable vascular system. So if something catastrophic happens, if something stresses that system to the breaking point,
everyone is going to assume the heart failed on its own. It's the most obvious culprit. It's the perfect camouflage for a neurological killer.
So let's go to the morning of the event. It's a regular day. The source says she's spending the morning with a close friend. Everything is totally normal.
No complaints of chest pain, no aura or warning signs that patients sometimes get before, say, a migraine or even some seizures, just normal.
And then everything changes in an instant. She has a witnessed generalized tonic-clonic seizure.
This is what most people picture when they hear the word seizure. It's what used to be called a grand mal. And it's the most dramatic and, frankly, the most dangerous type of seizure. It involves the entire brain all at once. The tonic phase is where all the muscles in the body stiffen violently. That often forces air out of the lungs, which can cause a cry or a moan.
And the clonic phase?
That's the rhythmic jerking of the limbs. She loses consciousness immediately. It's a complete electrical storm in the brain.
Her friend is watching all this happen. It must be absolutely terrifying. But then something happens that goes beyond even a standard severe seizure. The source describes copious pink froth dripping from her mouth.
That detail.
Yeah.
The pink froth. That is a terrifying hallmark of something called postictal neurogenic pulmonary edema.
Okay, let's stop and break that down because it sounds incredibly serious.
It is. So postictal means after the seizure. Neurogenic means it's coming from the brain, from the nervous system. And pulmonary edema is fluid in the lungs.
Okay, so fluid in the lungs caused by the brain after a seizure. But why is it pink and frothy?
To understand that, you have to think about the plumbing of the heart and lungs. The left side of your heart is a powerful pump that sends oxygenated blood out to your entire body. The right side pumps blood just to the lungs to pick up oxygen. During this massive seizure, her body is clamped down, the sympathetic nervous system goes into overdrive, and her blood pressure spikes to just incredible levels. We're talking about a massive adrenaline dump.
A catecholamine storm.
Precisely. So the left heart is now trying to pump against this massive system-wide resistance. It's like trying to push water through a hose that's been kinked shut, and it can't. It fails.
So the blood has nowhere to go. It backs up.
It backs up violently. The pressure wave goes backwards from the left heart into the pulmonary veins and then into the tiny, delicate capillaries that surround the air sacs in the lungs.
The alveoli.
Right. And the pressure gets so high, so fast, that it literally blasts fluid through the walls of those capillaries and floods directly into the air sac.
It bursts the pipes.
In a way, yes. It forces plasma and red blood cells right out of the bloodstream and into the lungs. The air she's trying to breathe then acts like a whisk, churning that bloody fluid into a pink foam. That's the froth.
So she's literally drowning.
She is drowning in her own body fluids, and it's being driven by the pressure wave from her brain.
That is a truly visceral image.
Okay.
So EMS is called. They arrive on the scene. The patient is postictal. The shaking has stopped, but she's not there.
No, she's combative. Which is a common post-seizure state. It's not aggression, it's confusion and a pure stress response.
But then her condition deteriorates rapidly. She turns cyanotic, she turns blue.
And this is the moment of cardiac arrest. The oxygen levels plummet, the heart gives out under the strain.
The EMS crew gets her on the monitor, and this is interesting. They find pulseless electrical activity, or PEA.
PEA is a very specific and a very tricky type of cardiac arrest. You know, in the movies you usually see flatline, which is a systole, or you see the chaotic squiggles of ventricular fibrillation. PEA is different. If you looked at the monitor, you might see a rhythm that looks like a totally normal heartbeat. The electrical system is firing. It's sending the signal beat, beat, beat.
But there's no pulse.
Exactly. The spark plugs are firing, but the engine won't turn over. The mechanical pump has failed completely, even though the wiring is still trying to work. It's often caused by a massive blockage or, in a case like this, most likely extreme metabolic stress and hypoxia, a profound lack of oxygen.
So the paramedics start CPR immediately. They are pushing on her chest to manually pump the blood for her. The paper says they do this for 5 minutes.
Which is an eternity when the brain isn't getting oxygen. Every second counts.
And they face a nightmare with her airway, They try to intubate her, to put a breathing tube down her throat, but they fail.
Intubation in the field is hard enough on a good day, but you add in her obesity, which can change the anatomy of the neck and make it harder to see.
And the copious pink froth.
And that! It's like trying to see through a windshield in a mudslide. They just couldn't visualize the vocal cords to pass the tube. It would be almost impossible.
So they're forced to use a bag valve mask, basically putting a mask over her face and pumping air in by hand, and they rush her to the hospital.
They do manage to get ROSC in the field return of spontaneous circulation. They get a pulse back, but she is incredibly unstable, hanging on by a thread.
She arrives at the emergency department. They finally manage to get the breathing tube in. And you'd think, okay, she's in the ER, she's intubated, she's safe now. But the storm isn't over.
Not even close. She crashes again.
This time it's ventricular fibrillation VFib.
So now the heart muscle is just quivering uselessly. It's that chaotic squiggle on the monitor. Then it degrades back into PEA again.
So they have to start CPR all over again. For another 6 minutes, they shock her with the defibrillator. They push epinephrine adrenaline, 2 full rounds of it.
They are throwing everything they have at her. It's essentially like trying to jumpstart a car while it's rolling downhill on fire.
And they manage to do it. They get her back again. They put her on vasopressors, powerful medications to clamp the blood vessels and keep her blood pressure from bottoming out, and they move her to the ICU.
But now the dust settles, the immediate crisis is over, and the doctors have to assess the damage. What's left?
And the physical exam in the ICU is just grim. The source describes her as deeply comatose, unresponsive to pain, unresponsive to voice.
Her pupils are fixed and non-reactive. They don't shrink when you shine a bright light in them. Her muscle tone is flaccid. These are all signs of deep, profound brain dysfunction. It means the brainstem reflexes, the most basic survival reflexes, are offline.
And her lungs, what do they find there?
Well, the doctors listen with a stethoscope and they hear diffuse, raunchian wheezes. It sounds like a swamp in there.
Mm.
And the chest x-ray confirms it. Severe bilateral pulmonary edema. Her lungs are completely whited out, just full of fluid.
Okay, so let's pause here. Put yourself in the shoes of the ICU doctor at that moment. You have a 60-year-old obese woman with a known history of heart arrhythmia and high blood pressure. She comes in with a cardiac arrest and her lungs are full of fluid. What is your working diagnosis?
99 times out of 100, you were thinking. Massive heart attack leading to cardiogenic shock and heart failure. You assume the pump broke. You assume her AFib threw a clot to her coronary arteries, or her arteries just clogged up. You treat the heart.
You don't look for a seizure as the cause.
Why would you? The seizure was just the collapse event. It's easy to assume the heart stopped first and then she shook because of lack of oxygen to the brain. We call that a convulsive syncope. It's very easy to write it off.
But this is where the entire story pivots. This is where we move into the second part of our investigation, the hidden history. Because on hospital day 2, a neurologist comes in for a consult, maybe just to assess the brain damage from the arrest.
And thank goodness they did. Because this neurologist does something that no high-tech CT or MRI scan can do. They sit down and they talk to the family. They dig for what we call collateral information.
And they find a ghost in the machine.
They do. They discover that this cardiac patient had a secret history. For years, her friends and family had noticed that she had these episodes of episodic staring.
Let's define that. What does that actually look like?
It's not just daydreaming. The descriptions in the report are very specific. She would suddenly stop whatever she was doing. She would stare blankly, completely unresponsive. You could call her name, wave a hand in front of her face, nothing.
And then what?
Then after a minute or two, she would come back, but she wouldn't be normal. She'd be confused. And she would have expressive aphasia. She would struggle to find her words, be unable to speak properly.
That post-event confusion, that's the key, isn't it?
It is the absolute smoking gun. In neurology, we call that the postictal state. And that combination, a behavioral arrest, the staring, followed by a period of confusion and aphasia, is the textbook presentation of a focal impaired awareness seizure.
What used to be called a complex partial seizure.
Exactly. It's a seizure that starts in one part of the brain and affects awareness. It's not the dramatic whole body convulsion, so it's often missed.
But she never went to a doctor for it.
Never. And this is a tragedy we see all too often, especially in older adults. People assume it's just aging. Oh, mom is just zoning out again. Oh, she's having a senior moment. Or sometimes they worry it might be dementia, so they hide it. They're afraid.
The source material also says these episodes had become more frequent in the months leading up to her death.
Her epilepsy was escalating, it was getting worse, it was completely uncontrolled and critically untreated. And that one piece of information from the family, it changes the entire narrative of her death. This wasn't a primary heart attack that caused a seizure. This was a seizure, a massive progression of her untreated epilepsy that killed the heart. It completely reframes the entire case. So, armed with this new theory that she's an epilepsy patient, the team looks again at the MRI they'd taken on day 4.
Right. And the main finding is what we'd expect. Global cerebral anoxic injury. Mm-hmm. That's the diffuse brain damage from the cardiac arrest.
Yeah.
The whole brain was starved of oxygen and you could see the damage everywhere. But
yeah.
There was something else.
Something that didn't quite fit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There was a specific lesion that stood out against that background of general damage.
A small, acute, right cerebellar ischemic infarction.
Let's break that down again. Ischemic infarction is a stroke. It means tissue death due to a lack of blood flow from a blocked vessel. Cerebellar means it happened in the cerebellum.
The little brain at the back.
Right. The part responsible for coordination, balance, motor control.
So why is a focal stroke in the cerebellum significant here? Why did that stand out? Because usually when the whole brain starves during global anoxia, certain very vulnerable areas tend to die. First, parts of the hippocampus, the basal ganglia, the cortex. These are areas with very high metabolic demand. A discrete focal stroke in one specific artery territory in the cerebellum is unusual in that context. It suggests a very specific mechanism, not just a general loss of oxygen to the whole system.
To another clue. But sadly, the global damage was just too severe. The prognosis was dismal.
There was no hope for a meaningful recovery.
And so the family made the incredibly difficult decision to withdraw life support, and she passed away. But the medical team, they couldn't let it go. They had this new diagnosis of epilepsy,
yeah.
And they had this weird, specific cerebellar stroke. So they went digging.
Into the archives, into her electronic medical record, and this is where the deep dive really earns its name. They find a record of a previous hospital admission from 16 months prior.
Right. She had been at the very same hospital.
And let's set the scene for that day because it's so important. She's at work, totally normal morning. She goes into the restroom. Her coworkers are just outside.
And then what happens?
Suddenly they hear a yelp from inside the stall.
A yelp.
That sound is absolutely chilling to a neurologist. It's very often the ictal cry. When a tonic-clonic seizure starts, all the muscles in the body contract at once, including the chest wall and the diaphragm. It forces air violently up through the vocal cords, which are also spasming shut. It creates this involuntary, high-pitched, often short cry or shriek.
So the coworkers hear this yelp, and then they hear uninterpretable noises.
Mm-hmm.
They realize something is wrong. They force the stall door open.
And they find her on the floor. She is combative. She can't speak. She can't follow commands.
So they call 911. EMS arrives. What are her vitals like this time?
Her body is in overdrive again. She is tachycardic. Her heart is racing. She is hypertensive. Her blood pressure is sky high. She's tachypneic. She's breathing way too fast. It's a state of extreme physiological stress.
She gets rushed to the hospital. And the doctors in the ER, seeing a patient who can't speak and is confused, they triage her as a code stroke.
Which makes perfect sense, right? She can't speak, which is aphasia. She's confused. She was found on the floor. If you see that clinical picture, you have to think stroke first. Time is brain.
But then this is where the mystery comes in. By the time she gets from the ER to the scanner for her MRI, she starts to wake up. She starts to improve.
Her mental status just clears up. The stroke neurologist comes to examine her and gives her an NIHSS score of 0.
And that's the National Institutes of Health Stroke Scale.
Yes. And a score of 0 means normal. No visible stroke symptoms, no paralysis, no slurred speech, full strength, full sensation.
So the stroke just disappeared.
It vanished. She had amnesia for the event. She didn't remember the bathroom or the fall at all. But physically, by the time she was examined, she was fine.
And they ran an MRI back then, 16 months ago, with that MRI show.
This is the moment in the case report that just makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up. That MRI from the event where she seemingly had a transient stroke and then walked out of the hospital showed a small, acute, right, cerebellar ischemic infarction.
Wait. A stroke in the cerebellum.
Yes.
Is it? Don't tell me it's in the same spot as the fatal one.
The authors state it was in the exact same vascular territory.
That is just uncanny. It's like lightning striking the same tree twice.
It's incredibly rare. I mean, think about it. Two separate events, 16 months apart. Both times she collapses with neurological symptoms. Both times she has a stroke in the exact same tiny branch of the brain's plumbing.
So looking back now, with the benefit of hindsight, was that first event actually a stroke at all?
The authors of this paper now argue, no, it was a seizure. A generalized tonic-clonic seizure in the bathroom. The yelp was the ictal cry.
And the stroke symptoms, the aphasia, the confusion.
That was the postictal state. And the stroke they saw on the MRI wasn't the cause of her collapse. It was the result of the seizure.
The seizure caused the stroke.
Exactly. The seizure happened first. It caused a profound physiological crisis that somehow damaged that specific part of the brain. And because she recovered so quickly, the doctors missed the real diagnosis. They saw the stroke on the MRI, which confirmed their initial suspicion, and they stopped there. They treated the result, and they completely missed the underlying cause.
And that misdiagnosis had fatal consequences 16 months later.
It did. It was a dress rehearsal for the final event.
This brings us to the core analysis of this paper, the real detective work. The authors took the lab data, the vital signs, everything from the fatal event and the data from that 2022 event, and they laid them out side by side.
And they found a pattern, a stereotype response.
Now, when we say stereotyped in medicine, we aren't talking about a cultural cliche.
No, not at all. We're talking about a biological script. It's like a computer program. Every single time the seizure.exe file ran in this woman's body, it executed the exact same lines of code, the same subroutines, regardless of the consequences.
Let's break down the lines of that deadly code, the biomarkers. The first one is a cardiac enzyme, troponin I.
Right. Troponin is the gold standard for diagnosing a heart attack, a myocardial infarction. It's a structural protein that's inside your heart muscle cells. It is not supposed to be in your bloodstream.
So it's floating around in your blood?
It means heart cells have died. They've ruptured and leaked their contents into the circulation. It's a direct marker of cardiac injury.
Okay, so in the final fatal event, her troponin spiked. That makes sense. Her heart stopped twice. But what about that first event? The one where she recovered and walked out feeling fine.
It also spiked. The graph in the paper is remarkable. It shows a transient elevation of troponin the first, following a nearly identical curve to the fatal event, just at a slightly lower peak.
So even though she didn't have a classic heart attack with a blocked artery, her heart was still being damaged. Yeah.
Precisely. This is what we call demand ischemia, or a type 2 myocardial infarction. Her coronary arteries weren't blocked by a clot, but the seizure drove her heart rate and blood pressure so high, so fast, that the heart muscle couldn't get enough oxygen to keep up with the extreme workload. It was running an ultramarathon without breathing, and parts of it started to die.
So high troponin after a seizure is a major warning sign. It says, this seizure was severe enough to physically injure the heart.
Exactly. It's a huge red flag that is, I think, often ignored or misinterpreted in the emergency setting.
Okay, that's biomarker one. Let's look at the second biomarker in this deadly script, leukocytosis. This is the white blood cell count.
Right. And usually if you see a really high white blood cell count in a patient, your first thought is infection. You think pneumonia, sepsis, appendicitis, something bacterial.
And in both events, her white blood cell count was sky high. The paper calls it frank leukocytosis. But she didn't have an infection either time.
No bacteria, no fever, no source of infection was ever found. This was post-convulsive leukocytosis.
How does a seizure create fake signs of an infection?
It's a fascinating mechanism. Think of your white blood cells, your leukocytes, like wallflowers at a school dance. Normally, about half of your total white blood cells are just kind of hanging out, stuck to the inner walls of your blood vessels. They aren't actively circulating. We call this the marginal pool.
Okay, so they're in reserve, waiting.
Right. But then the seizure hits. And with it comes that massive flood of adrenaline, of epinephrine we talked about. That adrenaline is a powerful chemical signal. It basically shakes the walls of the blood vessels. It causes all those wallflowers, all those marginated leukocytes, to detach and flood onto the dance floor into the circulating blood.
So suddenly the lab test shows the blood is full of them.
Exactly. The count spikes almost instantly. It's not that the body made new white blood cells, which takes days in the bone marrow. It's that it mobilized its entire reserve army all at once.
So if a doctor sees a high white count after a seizure, they shouldn't just jump to assuming it's pneumonia from aspiration.
They shouldn't. They should recognize it as another measure of the magnitude of the sympathetic stress response. The source even notes that the height of the white blood cell count often mirrors the severity of the respiratory compromise and the pulmonary edema. The worse the breathing, the higher the count.
So we have the heart signal, the troponin, and the immune signal, the leukocytes, repeating perfectly in her biological script. Now we have to talk about the most mysterious part, the brain signal, that recurrent cerebellar stroke.
This is the most fascinating and, I'll admit, the most speculative part of the entire case. Why the cerebellum? And why the exact same spot twice? Cerebellar strokes don't typically cause seizures. It's usually the other way around, with seizures happening after strokes in the cerebral cortex.
So this is backwards. The authors propose three theories for why this happened. Let's walk through them. Theory A is cardioembolism.
Right. This is the most straightforward idea. We know she had atrial fibrillation. The theory is that a small blood clot formed in her quivering heart, broke off, traveled up the bloodstream through the aorta, into the vertebral arteries, and just happened to lodge in that specific artery supplying the cerebellum.
Is that likely?
It's possible for it to happen once, but for a random clot to hit the exact same tiny terminal vessel, the posterior inferior cerebellar artery, or PLCA2, separate times, 16 months apart, the statistical odds are astronomical. It's like throwing a dart at a map of New York City from space and hitting the same mailbox twice.
Okay, so probably not that. What's theory B, hypoperfusion?
This is the low water pressure theory. The idea is that during the seizure, or especially during the cardiac arrest in the final event, her overall blood pressure drops so low, or the flow was so insufficient, that certain areas of the brain didn't get enough blood.
And this specific area was just the most vulnerable.
That's the idea. Maybe it was at the very end of its arterial supply, what we call a watershed area. Or maybe she had some pre-existing narrowing, some atherosclerosis in that specific vessel, making it the weak link in the chain that broke first when the pressure dropped. It's plausible.
But the authors seem to favor a third idea. Theory C, the aha moment, vasospasm.
This one fits the sympathetic storm narrative the best. Vasospasm means the blood vessel itself constricts violently. It clamps shut on its own.
Why would a blood vessel just strangle itself like that?
Because of the storm. Because of the catecholamines. This, the authors propose, is the unified mechanism of death. The mechanism of the heart damage, the immune response, and D, the stroke.
Okay, so let's visualize the storm. We're inside the body. The seizure starts in the brain.
The brain loses all normal regulation. It sends a massive, unregulated, chaotic electrical signal down the sympathetic nervous system, the fight or flight wiring. It's a panic signal of unimaginable intensity. It commands the adrenal glands to dump everything they have into the bloodstream.
A catecholamine dump. Adrenaline and noradrenaline just flooding the entire system.
And the levels can spike to 10 or even 100 times normal resting levels. This chemical tidal wave hits all the adrenergic receptors in the body. It hits the receptors on the heart, whipping it into a frenzy.
Which causes the troponin leak.
Yes. It hits the receptors on the blood vessel walls, causing the leukocyte demargination.
The leukocytosis.
And it hits the receptors on the smooth muscle of the arteries, telling them to tighten up to boost blood pressure. But in the cerebellum.
In that one specific artery.
In that one specific artery. Perhaps because she already had some underlying endothelial dysfunction or cholesterol plaque there that made it exquisitely sensitive. The vessel reacted too strongly. It went into spasm. It clamped shut completely, cutting off its own blood supply.
So the seizure directly commanded that blood vessel to cause a stroke.
That's the theory. And at the same time, that same flood of adrenaline is what's causing the heart to fail, the lungs to fill with fluid, and the blood to look like it's fighting an infection. It's a single, coordinated, multi-system attack on the body's own infrastructure, all orchestrated by the seizure.
And this leads to what the authors call the two-hit hypothesis. They argue she didn't die just because of the seizure.
Right. A healthy 20-year-old with pristine elastic blood vessels and a strong heart might survive that adrenaline storm. Their system could handle the stress. But our patient already had the first hit, her pre-existing vulnerability.
Her obesity, her hypertension, her stiff atherosclerotic arteries, her AFib.
Her entire cardiovascular system was already compromised. It was brittle. It had no reserve capacity.
And the seizure was the second hit.
The seizure was the trigger. It was the overwhelming stressor. Her system was like a dam that was already old and cracked and filled to the brim. The seizure was the sudden violent rainstorm that caused the catastrophic breach. The near SUDEP wasn't just a random bit of bad luck. It was a specific fatal interaction between her epilepsy and her cardiovascular health.
This brings us to our final segment, the implications. Why does this single tragic case matter so much to the doctor listening, or the patient, or their family?
It matters because near SUDEP is a ghost. It's rarely seen, rarely documented in this much detail. This case report is, according to the authors, the first to ever document these recurrent stereotyped subcortical strokes happening concurrently with the sympathetic swarm in a near SUDEP patient. It gives us a new pattern to look for.
So for the ER docs, the intensivists, the hospitalists out there, the lesson is to stop looking at the body in silos.
Exactly. Don't be the plumber who ignores the faulty wiring. If a patient comes in with what looks like a heart event or a stroke, but the story feels weird, they had a yelp, they were confused for a long time afterwards, they bit their tongue, their family mentioned staring spells, you have to think about epilepsy as the primary driver.
And look at the labs through that new lens. If you see elevated troponin and a high white cell count in a neuro patient, don't just dismiss it.
Don't just write it off as stress or a possible infection. See it for what it is. A signal that the body is under extreme threat from a sympathetic storm. It means that patient seizures are severe enough to damage the heart. It means that patient is, by definition, at high risk for SUD.
And for the families. I think the lesson here is just tragic, but it's also empowering.
It comes back to the history. The most important diagnostic tool in this entire case wasn't the MRI or the EEG. It was the neurologist asking the family one simple question. Did she ever stare?
Such a simple question.
That question unlocked the whole case. It reframed everything. And you have to wonder, if that question had been asked 16 months earlier after the code stroke, or 5 years earlier when the staring spells first started, she might have been diagnosed. She might have been put on anti-seizure medication.
And that might have prevented the second hit.
It might have saved her life. It's a stark reminder of the power of just listening to the patient's story.
It really makes you wonder, how many people are in the cemetery right now with a death certificate that says heart attack or cardiovascular collapse, but the real primary cause was an undiagnosed seizure disorder?
I suspect the number is much, much higher than we think. We so often say the heart stopped, it's the final event, but we rarely ask the next question. Who told the heart to stop? In many of these cases, it might just be the brain.
Who told the heart to stop? That is a haunting question to end on.
It is. The connection between the brain and the heart is invisible, but as this case shows, it can be absolutely lethal.
We've covered a lot of ground today. I mean, from the pink froth of pulmonary edema to the intricate chemistry of adrenaline storms and demarginating leukocytes. But the takeaway, I think, is crystal clear. The body keeps the score. And sometimes it plays the same tragic song twice before we finally learn to listen.
We just have to get better at recognizing the melody.
That's it for this deep dive. We'll see you next time. Stay curious, ask those simple questions, and always, always listen to the whole story.